Recorded live.
Hi, everybody. This is Greg Stewart, and this is Masonic Central. Today is our 19th episode. It's November 23rd, 2008. And this again is Greg Stewart and Dean Kennedy. How you doing, Dean?
Great. And you?
I'm good. I figured I'd ambush you early and ask you how you doing. This is, for those that don't know, the weekly podcast show for Freemasons by Freemasons, hosted to explore the depths of the Masonic world. If you're new to the program, visit our website at MasonicCentral.com and or send us an email at MasonicCentral@gmail.com. If you send us an email and we read it on the air, we will send you out some goodies to say thanks for it and try to bring in some of your dialogue into our dialogue. Look for upcoming shows that we have posted off our website at our calendar. We have shows running through about the end of this year, and we'll start filling up for next year, so stay tuned for that. And this show is a live program, so if you're listening to this podcast as a download, you can listen to us live on Sunday evenings, recording at 6 p.m. Pacific Time, 9 p.m. Central, and you can interact, contribute to the conversation, or just follow on live and listen to what we have to say. If you follow on live, we do have a chat room that you can come in and talk about the show and other things. All of this content is representative, of course, of the contributors and the hosts of the show and does not represent the opinion of any regular or irregular Masonic body or Grand Masonic Lodge. And this show is not a recruitment tool for any particular body. So we are simply here to talk about the wide world of Freemasonry. So, Dean, I understand we have some emails this week. Our pleas finally reached some ears. Thanks, everybody, who sent those emails in. What do we got there? Anything fun to read today?
Well, we have a few apologies for not sending emails and just having one automated email. But we had this one interesting one just to kind of show how far our show goes. And it starts, "Hey, guys, just wanted to email and say thank you for all the work you do. And I felt bad that you only had one automated email. I love the show, and I just finished my proficiency test for Entered Apprentice here in Japan with number 2 Tokyo Lodge, and I'm looking forward to the next level of learning." I'll just cut it off there, but it goes on a little bit. But just goes to show you that, you know, we have now gone international, and they listen to us in Japan now. And I'd like to say hello to Brother Pierce out there. And I hope you're enjoying your train ride, work, or wherever you go on your train rides, you listen to us, and that's great.
Hello, Brother Pierce. Yeah, it looks like we finally made it international. It's congratulations, Dean. That's great. You know, this podcast, it really is accessible by anybody across the world. So if you have friends or brothers who are Masons, let them know about us and let them know about the show. They can download future shows and past shows off our website. This week we have an interesting guest. We have Brother Chris Hodapp, who is the author of Solomon's Builders and the infamous book Freemasons for Dummies. How you doing this evening, Chris?
Wow, infamous. I'm doing fine. Thanks for having me. I enjoy being had. So.
Oh, our pleasure, our pleasure. You know, the running joke in the online community is this referral of the chief dummy of Freemasonry. And you know, looking at the book, I have to say you're anything but. So,
well, thanks very much. Actually, Brent Morris and I keep threatening to do a joint tour, the Total Dummy and Complete Idiot Tell You Everything There Is to Know About Freemasons. So.
Hey, you know, he mentioned that very same thing, and we chided him a little bit about it. But, you know, it actually might be a good idea, the Idiots and Dummies Tour of Freemasonry. That sounds terrible, but I'm sure it would be a great event. we like to start these interviews that we do and just to talk a little bit about who you are. So maybe you can tell us a little bit of who Chris Hodapp is.
Who Chris Hodapp is? Okay, well, let's see. For 25 years, I shot television commercials and feature films, and then decided about 6 years ago to plan for my retirement. Bought an apartment complex, which turned out to be a terrible idea, and my wife and I finally sold it last month, and we've officially turned in our plungers. So now it's pretty much a race to either make a living as full-time authors or figure out what I'm going to do when I grow up. So, but As far as my Masonic life goes, no one in my family had ever, to my knowledge, certainly in my close family, had ever been a Freemason, and I joined in November of 1998. Primarily because of the experience of my father-in-law's Masonic funeral down in Texas. And joined in 98, went through my entered apprentice degree, and joined a lodge that had fallen on hard times. And they were unable to get my fellow craft or Master Mason degree together with members of the lodge. So wound up getting sent to a one-day class for my fellow craft and Master Mason degree, and was instantly, after being raised, jabbed into a officer's position with a steward's pike. And so in December of 99, I was elected senior warden, and a year later I was made master of the lodge, 2 years after I became a Freemason. I don't recommend doing that.
It sounds like a quick pace there.
Yeah. You know, and what's interesting is that when I would tell that story 7 years ago, people would be shocked and shake their heads and go, "Oh my goodness, you know, that's terrible. What a terrible experience." And now, as I tell that story, I see a lot of heads nodding in audiences, and I get told that that's more common than you would believe at this stage of the game. So
more often the case, yeah. You know, yeah. It's interesting with some of our past guests that we've had. That topic has come up a lot. The whole aspect of 1 day classes, and it's interesting to hear that you're actually one of the recipients of it.
Yeah.
It's
interesting because I think that the situation that I notice happening as I talk to people is that 1 day classes were developed as sort of a stopgap measure, and study after study has shown that you get the same kind of retention of people whether they go through a 1 day class or whether they go through the traditional method of one degree at a time. The difference is that I think what you have happening now is I talk to more and more young officers that are coming in. They'll go through a one-day class experience and then come back to their lodge and say, "Let's not do that again. You know, let's find a way." Oh, seriously, they're saying, "Let's find a way that we can confer degrees on an individual basis with our lodge, and not have to send anybody to 1 day classes again." So on the one hand, I don't like them. I don't agree with them. On the other hand, I think they have a tendency to die out on their own because in situations where you've got states like Ohio, where they raised like 5,000 in 1 day. You know, 5 or 6 years ago across the state. Well, then the next one, it was 3,000. And then the next one, it was 1,500. You know, you can only go to that bush two or three times to beat it, to get, get the granddads that never got their grandkids to join or the neighbor. You know, you can only do that so many times. And I think they lose their popularity fairly quickly. And again, it generates an attitude with young officers of, "Let's not do that. Let's find a way, if it's to you know, bring in a degree team or work with another lodge or assemble three or four lodges to try and find a way to confer degrees on an individual basis again." So I think they'll burn themselves out on their own.
Yeah, it seems even from the dialogue that it has been much just a stopgap to a certain situation that once it's done, they kind of realize, well, we could have done it a different way. But certainly with their purpose. And curious with that, having gone through it that way and completed the work that you did, after that 1 day experience, do you find a lot of work in the lodge to bolster up your education to it, or is it something that you had to go back and sort of pick up on your own?
Well, no, what was interesting was that our lodge, when I say our lodge had fallen on hard times, the year that I was raised, throughout the course of that year, we lost 5 officers in less than a year. You know, got married, went to college, had a baby, moved away, got mad, you know, for whatever reason. We lost 5 guys out of the officers line. And so it was, I mean, we were really decimated. Well, the year that I became master, the very first meeting that we had, I mean, the very first business meeting was to consider the question, you know, do we close, do we merge, do we sell the building, do we just shut down, what do we do? Our lodge in particular is in sort of a bohemian neighborhood in Indianapolis that is surrounded by nightclubs and little theaters and art galleries and this kind of thing. And I said, you know, can we give me a chance? You know, I just got here. You know, let's take a year and see if we can interest that. You know, in any given night, 5,000 guys from the demographic that we would love to attract drive by this building and don't even know it's here. And shame on us. That's stupidity on our part. If we can't sell Freemasonry in this neighborhood, there's something wrong with us. and so in the year that I was master, either raising candidates or bringing in transfers from other lodges, I think we brought in four or five. The next year we brought in four or five. Then the next year, six or seven. And it was a slow, gradual build. That lodge as it exists today, I would say we've probably since that time brought in a total of maybe 70 guys over the course of that time. Stated meetings are anywhere from 16 to 22 people showing up, and so it's truly turned around. But what is encouraging more than anything else is what all of the masters that followed my year really concentrated on was making sure that these guys became friends before any other concentration. So they truly care about each other. They look out for each other. They help each other find jobs. They help each other find a place to live. I mean, that's the kind of relationship among the members that we have really worked very hard to try and foster. And that's truly how you build a successful lodge. You know, you can concentrate on ritual, you can concentrate on the philosophy, you can concentrate on all the trappings that surround Freemasonry, but at its core, if you're not creating friendships, if you're not truly creating brotherhood, then you don't stand a chance. And that's why our lodge has turned into a success.
Very interesting. And from that success and from those brothers that have come in, have you noticed a growth in their activity together, or have you seen a growth in their activity together, or is that just?
Oh, absolutely. I mean, every Thursday night is something having to do with that lodge. If it isn't degree work, and the degree work has just been like clockwork. It's been steady for the past probably 2.5 to 3 years now. It is not unusual to have degree work at least 2 out of the 4 weeks of the month, and they'll schedule time off of that just to give everybody a break. But they do social nights, they do they do movie nights, they do practice nights. If nothing's going on, they'll do a pub crawl. It's the friendships that develop in there, and they socialize together on weekends. Several have become roommates, and the wives and the girlfriends are taking part as well, and that's truly where the success of a Masonic lodge gets built. When you truly start caring about each other, that's where a Masonic lodge becomes the biggest possible success. Because if you're just strangers that come and a lodge becomes a place that you meet and flee, the meeting becomes the be-all and end-all, you're not operating from a basis of strength.
Yeah. Hey, you know, it just seems to be one of the assumed things about the lodge itself is that aspect of fraternity. But who would ever have thought that it took so much work to actually make it something realistic and something that functions, you know, to actually put it into place? That's a great story. I mean, it sounds like it's really come back. Do you belong to any other independent bodies? Do you actually get outside of the Blue Lodge and get into the others?
Oh yeah, I'm a member of the Scottish Rite, although I'm not real active in that. I'm in the York Rite bodies. I'm an officer in the Commandery. I'm a Sovereign Master, going into my second year as Sovereign Master of an AMD Council. A member of the Shrine. So, yeah, you know, and it just depends. My schedule has been so bizarre that obviously you can't do everything. But I do the, you know, I mean, I concentrate on the things that I really enjoy. And I'm involved in Commandery. It's funny, I got involved in Commandery because a group of us decided to start a medieval period reenactment degree team for the Commandery. We do the Order of the Temple in 75 pounds of chain mail with broadswords and tunics and steel helmets.
Wow. That actually sounds pretty impressive.
And we do that. We only try and do that once or twice a year, so that it doesn't turn. It's called Levant Preceptory, and we try and keep it to a few times a year, so it doesn't turn into, oh, here come those guys in their chain mail again. You know, I mean,
Just a question. When you're doing your chain mail degree, like, what's wash and break like? It must be hell.
Yeah, it sort of is.
Kilts, lots of kilts.
Yeah, well, we discovered there really is a need for squires. You really need help, especially when you're a little butterball like me. The possibly the worst experience I ever had was the Grand Master 2 years ago asked us to take part in the big parade at the Indiana Masonic Home Festival, and it was like 95 degrees, and you know, one comedy of errors after another. I had to move my car, and the parade started without me. So here comes little butterball with congestive heart failure and 75 pounds of steel trying to lope across the parade grounds to catch up with the parade. Thought I was going to die.
It's not funny, but story-wise, I can imagine. That's one to tell the grandkids there.
Yeah, sure. Yeah, have a good laugh
like
at
a
my
grandpa.
Expense. Yeah. There goes the dummy running across the field. Yeah.
All right, you know, it comes down to dedication.
I guess. Or stupidity, one of those.
Hand in hand. Dan, I mean, just in going from that, then, with that dedication in mind, and even with all the chainmail in mind, one of the things that I wanted to talk about was the Knights of the North, and I understand that you were part of their early inception.
The Knights of the North. It's funny. The Knights of the North was sort of a. It was a term that we developed because we didn't know how else to really credit the thing. The Laudable Pursuit is a paper that has sort of been shot around the internet. And what it was is it grew out of internet conversations on a private forum with six or seven of us, largely from Indiana, but not entirely. We were having conversations on how to improve lodges, how to improve the lodge experience, and then we started. We took the theory of Dwight Smith's writings from the 1960s, Why This Confusion of the Temple, and in his books he asked a series of questions and then had a series of pitfalls the fraternity should have avoided, and the fraternity didn't avoid any of them, and nobody answered any of his questions, and as a result he sort of predicted the direction that Freemasonry would go from the mid 1960s, and he was pretty much dead on. So we said, okay, the time has come to quit sitting online or going out in public and doing the equivalent of sitting in a bar room pointing your finger in the air going, you know what's wrong with this fraternity? Because the answer is yes, we've all identified what's wrong with this fraternity. It's been identified for 50 years. And if you go back 100 years, you'll see a lot of the same complaints being written about in Masonic newspapers and magazines over the years. So maybe the answer is let's start trying to identify solutions instead of endlessly bitching about it. Put your money where your mouth is and start coming up with solutions. So the conversation started over the internet, and we started trying to come up with some answers to Smith's questions, and it just sort of grew and grew. And so the Knights of the North became sort of this generic term for what we were calling ourselves, because it was easier than trying to, you know, than trying to identify who said what or whatever. They became sort of these massive answers that built upon that conversation. So
very interesting. And at the time that it was published, because I know that was one of the early documents that I came across in just my early forays onto the net, and was surprised at the limited amount of exposure that it had. You know, it was this one little paper buried on a website. I'm curious, how well was it received at the time? Did it get a broad release?
At the time that it came out. In Indiana, no, there were calls for a bunch of us to be suspended. How dare we question anything about the status quo? There were others that applauded it and said, isn't this great? Now, remember also, a group of us were also involved in starting a European concept lodge in Indianapolis, so it was part of the same group, Lodge Vitruvian number 767. And so we were putting some of these things into practice in Lodge Vitruvian, but we were also trying to look at the broader scope of the fraternity and trying to make it not so Indiana-centric and trying to look outside of just what was going on in our own backyard and look at it from a larger point of view. So, but yeah, in Indiana, there were people that wanted to hang us out to dry. And what's funny is, again, like talking about the short time to becoming a master. 5 years ago, there were people who thought that this was blasphemy. In the last 2 years, I've had three Grand Masters walk up to me at their Grand Lodges and hand me a copy of Laudable Pursuit and say, what is in here has become the basis for my planning for my year of things that I want to try and change in the fraternity. So it's in a very brief period of time, it's gone from this anathema from a bunch of heretics to something that's spreading around the fraternity and ideas are being grabbed from it. So that's really gratifying.
Hey, have you seen much of it actually being implemented? Have you heard stories from folks across the country who put the different aspects of it into play?
Oh yeah, I have. I was at a Grand Lodge, and the Grand Master came up to me and he said, listen very carefully to the requirements for my Grand Master's award because some of it's going to sound familiar. And he said the very first requirement is that you gain bonus points toward the Grand Master's award for every meeting you don't read the minutes in. You know, I mean, it's that kind of stuff. So, bits and pieces people are obviously cherry picking ideas and you know, using what they like and not using what they don't like. But it was never intended as a blueprint for anything. It was intended to start the dialogue, here are my ideas, show me yours. You know, this is a starting point.
Interesting. Yeah. Like work points, something to give somebody to work on. I know when I came across it, I was very impressed with it, and at the time had no idea who the Knights of the North were and just knew that this paper existed and that it was just sort of out there. Do you think that there's still room for it to grow? Are there still things to implement into it in a broader spectrum, or do you think that it still goes back to
sure.
the grassroots
aspect? Oh, sure.
Aspect?
Sure, absolutely. But the real truth of the matter is the real success of lodges has got to come from lodges themselves. It's got to be at the grassroots level. It was funny. I was I'm not going to say where, but I was speaking at a Scottish Rite gathering, and it was funny. There was an elderly man on the front row, and he's asking questions, and he stands up, and he gets this really evil look on his face, and he says, "Don't you think that Grand Lodges are doing everything they can to destroy lodges?" And, you know, I mean, he had this anger about him that, you know, he obviously had, there was some issue that Grand Lodge had done that just thoroughly enraged him. And I looked up and I said, no, Grand Lodge can't destroy your lodge and Grand Lodge can't fix your lodge. You know, if your lodge is having problems and your lodge is failing and not attracting people and not keeping the guys who come in and you're boring your members to death and you're serving lousy food and everybody wants to come and meet and flee, Grand Lodge isn't doing any of that to you. And I really believe that people that say that somehow Grand Lodge is wrecking the lodge experience. Sorry, you need to look closer to home for that problem, because Grand Lodge isn't wrecking your lodge.
It definitely comes back to the whole idea of a disconnect of a responsibility of sorts, you know. And this is something that I've just kind of concluded on my own, is that we are sort of out there on our own doing this. There isn't anybody else to do this work.
Well, exactly. You've got people who sit there and say, you know, well, we need reduced proficiency because guys don't want to learn the catechism. And we need to be able to solicit members because nobody knows about Freemasonry anymore. And we need to loosen all kinds of rules in order to make all this easier. And Grand Lodge have responded by saying, okay, done. Solved. Problem solved. We're putting up billboards next week. We're letting you ask now. The only proficiency they're going to have to learn are the grips and signs and words. We'll have one-day classes. Okay, problem solved. Okay? Now what's your excuse? Oh, you still lost members last year? Oh, you still managed to bring in three guys and all three of them never came to the second business meeting that you bored them all at? Grand Lodge isn't doing that to your lodge.
No, not at all.
Are you trying to say that their lodges are boring?
Yes.
Just checking.
Honestly, because when you look around the country and you start looking at demographics, now this isn't true in every state, but when you start looking at demographics, overwhelmingly in Grand Lodges now, the big waves of the World War II generation, the big death rate among the World War II generation has tapered off. We're at the bottom of that bell curve. And so... overwhelmingly, in the majority of jurisdictions, you're finding that we're losing more members to non-payment of dues and to MITs than we are to the death rate. So, sorry, Grand Lodge isn't doing that. That's our responsibility. That's our fault. We are failing at the lodge level to interest them and to get them to come back.
To engage. It comes down to engaging. Just like you said, the fellows that would be traveling down the street to go to those clubs and pubs right there, right next door to you, and having no idea you exist. It's amazing how often I hear people say, I had no idea you were there, or have no clue as to what they are.
Right.
You know, or vague memories back to a grandparent.
Right. Now I've on the same token, I've got people, you know, you'll read on the internet these guys that just go ballistic and tear their hair out and say, "Oh my God, Freemasonry advertising. Oh God, that's such an anathema. Putting up billboards, we might as well just shoot ourselves." Well, okay. I was just in Washington last week talking to a documentary crew, and they were talking about the Masonic procession that went to go lay the founding boundary stone for the city of Washington, D.C., and then the other procession that went to go lay the cornerstone of the presidential mansion, and the other much bigger ceremony and procession of three lodges and you know, all their regalia and their banners flying and their officers and their jewels and everything marching up the hillside up to lay the cornerstone for the Capitol building. What do you think they were doing? Oh, they were advertising their presence. When you look at writings of the 1700s and the 1800s, by the early 1800s, you've got all kinds of things in newspapers and magazines of the period that make it clear that the people of that age, most people knew who and what the Freemasons were and what they stood for. Whether they were members or not, they knew who and what they were. Overwhelmingly, if you said Freemasons in 1800, people knew exactly what the Masons were and what they stood for. Now, that isn't true today. People look at you like the dog talked when you say Freemason. They don't know what that is. Now, 30 years ago, everybody knew who what the Masons were, but they don't know what it is today. So our job is five times as hard right now. Not only do we need to attract new men to the fraternity and show them why the fraternity would be good for them to join, but we also have to educate the public as to who and what we are, because we got out of everybody's habit. We fell off the radar screen.
Out of memory, yep. Go ahead.
Chris, one question is popping up on the board here, and perhaps you're seeing it, is the question we had a few modern day television ads running, and one of them was the Ben Franklin ad, and
uh-huh.
We're asking, there was some mixed reviews about that particular ad, and I was wondering, how did you feel about, you know, that type of modern day television ad about masonry?
I thought it was very well done, and it was funny because Indiana, the Grand Lodge of Indiana, thought so highly of those ads that Massachusetts did that not only did we buy the rights to air them here, but we actually had them modified a little bit so that they weren't so Massachusetts-oriented, and we ran them here. What I loved about those ads were the messages that were within them. Instead of just a knee-jerk reaction of, oh, my God, television ads for the Masons, we might as well slit our throats, if you listen to the message that's in those ads, they really and truly hit home. Because they talk about, Franklin says in those ads, I'm not seeing something in society that used to be so important in society, which was tolerance. And I'm finding that I can find that in Freemasonry. And then when he says at the end of the ads, you know, is there greatness in you? It's bringing that, it's trying to, in 30 seconds, bring a little bit of Masonic philosophy to educate people in as brief a period as possible, sort of what we're about. I didn't have a problem with those ads. I thought they were very, very well done. I thought they were very tastefully done. There are people who hated them simply because of advertising for Freemasonry just absolutely rubs them the wrong way. But again, I submit that, you know, you'll hear stories. If you talk to older guys, you'll hear them tell stories about that dad that walked around with a folded up a petition in his wallet for 20 years waiting for his son to ask to join the lodge, and the son never asked, and he'd never asked the son, and you know, he died a bitter man because his son never asked to join the lodge. That's crazy. And in a larger sense, we have that problem now. We have a whole society that doesn't even know we exist, that doesn't know what we stand for, that doesn't know the philosophy, that doesn't know our history. And what are we going to do? We're going to hide it under a bushel? What's good about that? What's smart about that? Does that make us better?
It goes back to what you were saying, what they used to do in past centuries, the parades, the press that they used to write for themselves, the advertisements, the frequency at which that they put themselves out there to the public, to just about them and just elicit that interest.
In 1898, the Freemasons of Chicago built the tallest skyscraper in the world. Now, that wasn't advertising? Yeah, I mean, do you think they didn't promote that in the press and tell everybody that that was the headquarters of Freemasonry in Chicago and we've got the tallest building in the world? You think they tore the sign off the building and didn't want anybody to know that? You know, there's another great picture. I think it's in Baltimore. I think it's the Grand Lodge building in Baltimore, and there's a picture from like 1902. And if you look at it carefully, it's a daylight picture, but if you look at it carefully, you can see that the building has been strung with like giant Christmas lights all over it to make the square and compass, to make the Templar cross, to, you know, all these Masonic symbols are lit up so that you could have spotted it from low Earth orbit when they turn all the lights on at night, you know.
Self-promotion.
For us to think that advertising is number one is terrible for the fraternity, and number two is some new innovation that we shouldn't be engaging in is just sheer foolishness.
Now, Chris, what's your idea? I think that there's a way to advertise though, or increase our awareness without spending a lot of money on TV ads and stuff too. Like what happened to just advertising by getting out there and doing or getting involved in the community? I mean, that's something that's been discussed as well, right? So
yeah, I mean, I don't disagree. What I think is one of the greatest ideas to come out, and again, like, you know, I have to begrudgingly admit, a lot of great ideas coming out of Massachusetts. A bunch of guys in Massachusetts about maybe 10, 12 years ago came up with the Masonic Angel Fund concept, which basically your neighborhood lodge works with the social workers at, you know, you just pick one local school to work with, and you cover things like winter coats or glasses or backpacks. cuts, or, you know, things that are not catastrophic, things that don't cost a couple of $1,000, things that just cost a couple of $100, but that the usual social program doesn't pay for. You know, that kind of stuff falls through the cracks. And the difference of that from being some big institutionalized charity is that you're actually helping the kids right down the street, you know, the people that are within the neighborhood of your lodge. You're not making a big show of it. You're not patting yourself on the back going, what a good bunch of boys we are. And it isn't costing your lodge a fortune. And yet you're making a huge difference in individual lives. I think that's a lot more important than some massive institutionalized charity.
Absolutely. Absolutely. Not to move away from the subject, I have a funny feeling we could probably stick to this subject the whole night. One of the things that I wanted to try to talk about a little bit was how that work from Laudable Pursuit and the Knights of the North moved into doing the Dummies book, which I'm sure had a lot to do with your activities like this out there in the public.
Well, when Laudable Pursuit started circulating on the internet, and we presented it as a paper at Lodge Vitruvian, it very quickly came to the attention of the Grand Master in Indiana. There were some people that were calling for our heads, and he didn't happen to agree with that theory. And it just about coincided with the release of National Treasure. When National Treasure came out at Thanksgiving of, 04 or 05, isn't that terrible? I can't remember. I think it was 04.
Actually, 03, believe it or not. It was a long time
really?
Ago.
Was it 03? Really?
Huh. I think it was, yeah.
So when National Treasure came out, it was the number one movie in America for like 4 weeks. And so Wiley Publishing, the people who published the Dummies books, had a sales meeting, and one of their head acquisitions editors ran into the meeting and said, gosh, I just saw this movie. It's the number one movie in the country. It's about these Freemason guys. We don't have a book about them. Call somebody. Get somebody. And it happens that they have a headquarters here in Indianapolis. They originally started here in Indianapolis. The Dummies books did, largely as computer manuals years ago. And so one of the girls in the meeting said, well, my dad's a Freemason in Indianapolis. Let me call him and see if they know of somebody. And they called the Grand Lodge office, and the Grand Master said, yeah, I got a guy just dumb enough to write that book. So that's literally how it happened. Literally how it happened.
This seems to be a common thread between a lot of you guys. Right time, right place. That's pretty cool, actually. That's interesting. I never knew that story, that's how it ended up in your hands.
It caused a little tension here in the house. My wife's been trying to get a novel published for years, and then a call comes out of the blue, and I get offered to write the book. So, you know, a little tense here, a little tense. But literally, God on his cloud pointing down, going, you.
Do this. So, and this isn't the only Dummies book that you've put pen to. You've got several now, if I'm not mistaken.
Right. Yeah. After Freemasons for Dummies, based on how well it did, another publisher called and was in an absolute blind panic. Said, "Well, we want you to do a book about the sequel to Da Vinci Code that Dan Brown's going to write." I said, "What is that?" I said, "Well, it's about Freemasons. You ought to know all about it, right?" No, I mean, the guy could fool you and write a cookbook. Who knows what he's going to write about? But that project turned into Solomon's Builders, which is about the Freemasons and the Founding Fathers and the building in Washington, D.C. And that was done for Ulysses Press. And then the Dummies people wanted, they contacted Alice and I to do a book about the Knights Templars. And originally we had gone to them with a proposal to do a book basically about secret societies, and they concentrated really heavily on, but we want to do the secret societies from Dan Brown's book. And so that sort of turned into talking about the Templars and then some of the other stuff in Da Vinci Code. And that eventually became the Templar Code for Dummies, a title that only a giant publisher could invent. And, we kept saying, no, Da Vinci Code fever will be done by the time this book comes out. No, that will last forever. So the Templar Code for Dummies, which covers the Knights Templar and in both the medieval form and in the modern form, and the organizations that have either claimed direct descent from them or just influenced by them. And then immediately following that, they said, okay, your secret society book, well, that's still a good idea. Let's expand it. And that became secret or conspiracy theories and secret societies for dummies. So I think the dummies people have finally figured out my nefarious plot, which is every book I write to insert a major chapter about the Freemasons in it. So
keep building on. So with the secret societies book, was that a every late night listening to Art Bell for research sort of a book?
Yes, unfortunately, yes. And I wish you could see our research library for that book. I've never been so embarrassed about some of the books we had to order.
I can imagine Zachariah Sitchin to what was the other fellow's name? Hogan with the face on Mars.
Yeah. Yes. Yeah. Hogan's face on Mars. Oh my God.
There was a time a few years ago when conspiracy theories were all the rage, but it seems that it's sort of fallen off a bit.
Yeah.
Have you gotten any heat or a lot of fan mail for the book?
Hearing
anything about it?
I'm a willing henchman of the Bohemian Grove and the Bilderbergers and the Council on Foreign Relations and all the other international secret groups, and of course the Illuminati, naturally, that control the world, and I'm just their willing
stooge.
Forget
the New World Order.
Yeah, it's all there on the dollar bill. Everybody knows it. It's a big secret. Everybody knows about it.
it's the secret hiding in plain sight.
And
you and I, we joked a little bit about this a few weeks ago. All these efforts and ideas swirling around with Dan Brown's new book. And here we are now years later and no Dan Brown book.
Yeah, I mean, I personally think that every time a National Treasure movie comes out, his wife spends 3 days talking him in off the ledge. It's one of those deals where he told everybody 5 years ago what he was going to write about. He said it was going to be about the Freemasons. It was going to be in Washington, D.C., and then promptly didn't write anything for 5 years, which sort of gave everybody the opportunity to pile on and second guess what all these plot points would be. So I think he's, face it. Now, in all fairness, with the money that he made off Da Vinci Code and Angels and Demons, he doesn't have to write a grocery list for the rest of his life. But on the other hand, you've written the sixth most popular book in the history of the English language. How do you write a sequel to that? Especially when, you were just this little thriller writer. You weren't trying to do anything profound. You were just trying to make money as a thriller writer, and suddenly people have just turned it into this mania. So I think he's staring at the computer while beads of blood form on his forehead, trying to figure out what he's going to write about.
While reading all the books that have been written for him to tell
the
story.
Well, and that was saying nothing of two major lawsuits that hit him too, which I'm sure was not a pleasant experience either. So there are, on the one hand, Doubleday just let go 10% of their employees in New York, not because Dan Brown didn't write a new book, but because Dan Brown didn't write a new book. And and then, you know, but you got Angels and Demons movie coming out this year. So there are people that are saying, all right, well, once that comes out and finally it gets into video release and everything, then that'll be the time, and he'll come out with it in time for next Christmas. So, so the bookstores don't know how to act without a new Harry Potter or a new Dan Brown book. They're willing to close stores because of that. So,
we'll keep writing the books for them and let them publish Freemason stuff.
Sure.
And, so now with all these books going on, you've taken on another task now and are the lead, editor in chief, for lack of a better word, for the journal.
I am. I'm the editor in chief of the Journal of the Masonic Society, which is a new research organization that that started up. We officially opened our doors in May, while I was lying flat on my back in a hospital room. Probably not good timing there. And the first issue came out. Gosh, what's it been about 6-8 weeks ago, and has been very well received. And it was real gratifying that when we formed the organization, we started the Masonic Society, and literally based on nothing but a website and a promise, we got about 500 people to sign up and throw $39 at it to give us a chance. The result has been very gratifying. The first issue has been very well received, and we're growing. So our first annual meeting is going to be at Masonic Week in Washington in February. It's just growing by leaps and bounds, and couldn't be happier.
That's great. Did you find the doing the journal much different than publishing the books? Were you on tighter schedules?
No. I'll tell you what, the schedule for the Dummies books are horrific. You are literally given from the time you sign the contract to the time that you have to turn in the last of the material is 4 months.
Wow.
Yeah.
That's a turnaround.
Yeah, and just to bore you with those details, you know, the manuscript will be 348 pages long, period. And you get 4 months, and you have to turn in the material in very specific, in 6 week increments. Yeah, they hold you a deadline. Now, in all fairness to them, they've done this a few times. They've got over 1,000 different titles in the series, and overwhelmingly, on the overwhelming majority of the books, they work with first-time authors who aren't necessarily used to writing to deadlines and who don't fully understand the process. So they're covering their backsides too, and they're sort of hedging their bets against somebody who won't be able to finish the book or isn't any good when they started, or you know, that kind of thing. So from that standpoint, no, the magazine. And the other thing is, I don't have to write all the content for the magazine. So
you know, sometimes though, being that ringleader behind it is much more work than actually being the guy who writes it. At least writing it, you know your schedule.
Yeah. Yeah, there is that. And, of course, naturally I said yes to the job before I understood how to use Adobe InDesign. So there was sort of a quick ramp up on how to use the software to put it together. So I had a lot of firsts to go through. First time working with a publisher on a full-time or on a full-color publication. So blessedly few errors on that.
It's a beautiful journal. I had no idea what to expect early on, and as soon as I got it out of the envelope that it came in, it was very impressive, I have to say.
Well, the hope all along was that it was, you know, we said there is no North American version of Freemasonry today. You know, we wanted something that was a combination between National Review and Time Magazine. That you know, if you're publishing a full color magazine, then take advantage of it. You know, put in some beautiful photography and some interesting artwork, and have a eye pleasing design to the magazine, and yet also make sure that the substantial meat of the thing is well researched, well documented articles, but also have a good mix so that in any given issue there are at least two articles that you really like.
Have you gotten much feedback from it? I guess nationally and even internationally. This is going to a wider audience, I presume.
Yeah.
Have you heard much back on it?
Yeah, feedback has been very, very good about it, and again, I'm very gratified on that. So obviously, the challenge is you got to follow it up. You know, you got to hit four issues a year with it, and so trying to keep encouraging people to submit to it. By the way, Greg's artwork is going to be on the cover of issue 2, and very glad that he stepped in and did that. So happy to do that.
My pleasure. You know, I wasn't going to say anything because I thought about it last week, and it's like, ooh, that might be like a giveaway for the next one.
Underline in bold type, there is no quid pro quo. I did not come on the show in order to compel him to submit something to the magazine. It just worked out that way.
Chris, did you get my artwork I did on the Etch-a-Sketch yesterday?
Cool. I hate that when you drop it, though, because it erases. But then,
that's page 2. That's page 2. No, and if anything else, if just in testament to the work that goes into it, I think you had just even dropped the question to me a week and a half ago to put it on there and just to pull something out and get it written up for you just to have a little bit of something to go with it.
Yeah.
So I would hate to be a ringleader of trying to corral the sheep into to corral the cats in corral the cats into to the barnyard. It's a lot of work.
Yep.
It's a lot of work. So I definitely appreciate it. If anybody hasn't looked at it, I definitely recommend that you check it out. I've got my copy sitting here next to me. So with the feedback, and this is sort of a loaded question, but just in curiosity as to how it broadens out. Do you see the journal taking a leadership role in the future of the fraternity, broadening education maybe, or do you see it as a society itself?
I'm sorry, I didn't hear the first part of what you said. Say it again, please.
Oh, I was just that. Do you see the journal taking a broader leadership role, or do you see it just existing as just an organ of the society? Do you think that it'll have much impact outside of the society and the general reading public?
Well, I certainly hope that it does. The desire all along has been, a couple of things on the Masonic Society is that from the very beginning we said we're not just selling a subscription to a magazine. We're selling membership in an organization, and it goes back to that core philosophy of within a Masonic lodge that if you don't build a brotherhood there, if you don't build friendships there, then you're building on a sandy foundation. So the same is true with the Masonic Society. We felt that you're trying to build an organization. You're trying to build friendships within Freemasonry. So that's why the magazine will have news of the membership, what's going on. And that's why we're having the annual meetings at Masonic Week, and then we're also going to have halfway through the year we're going to have meetings outside of Washington. We're going to take them somewhere else, and we're working on possibility of California being the location of our first semi-annual meeting.
It's funny you mention that. I actually, and even just what comes to mind, even just like regional meetings.
Yeah.
Know?
Well, and again, if you dilute it too much, if you put too much on a local group and say, okay, you're the representatives of the Masonic Society in Des Moines, Iowa, you know, put something together and have a big meeting. Well, you might get two or three guys show up for that, but you know, the hope is to try and do these semi-annual meetings around the country, and really build a following for that as well. The other thing that we're trying to do is we're really trying to encourage research lodges and Masonic research organizations that, you know, you'll have a you know, every state has got one. Almost every state has got one. It's got a research lodge. And so somebody will present a paper at that, and maybe they'll publish it every couple of years, or maybe they won't. Maybe that paper will just sink into obscurity and go back into a guy's bottom drawer, never to be seen again. And what we're saying is we want to be your partner in that. We want to, you know, we want to be a place where a national and an international audience can read the fruits of your labors, and you can really get a broader audience. So it's our hope in the coming months to get research lodges interested in publishing in the journal as well.
That'd be interesting to see. I would really be curious about it. Just the content itself is enough to keep you going all month. I could see it as it starts getting broader and bigger with more of its contributions. Do you think that it's going to have much interaction with other bodies, or do you think it's going to stay pretty much true to just craft lodges? Will there be much intersection with York Rite, Scottish Rite?
No, I think there will. I think there will. The first issue, we had two articles concerning Scottish Rite initiation degrees, and we're going to get more York Rite as well. I mean, again, hard to tell from the first issue, but it's our hope to expand into that. The other thing that I find interesting is that obviously this kind of stuff doesn't exist in a vacuum, and the hope is all along has been, you know, people sit there and say, well, don't you have competition from other groups? You know, the Knight Templar magazine, the Scottish Rite Journal, the Phil Lathes magazine. And you know, I come from the advertising world, and I fully believe competition raises all boats. You know, if there's competition out there that forces other magazines to work harder and improve the way they look and the articles that are in them and the level of research, then good for all of us. In the end, that more is better for us. Yeah, and I see the Knight Templar magazine is making changes already. They're talking about going to full color. They're talking about going to a full-size format. They put together an editorial committee. I know Stephen Defoe is on that and several others. And so, you know, again, if competition is making the other publications in the Masonic world look around and say, hey, you know, maybe we need to raise the level as well, then good for all of us.
It only serves to benefit everybody, I think, at the end of the day.
Yeah.
Absolutely. Absolutely. One of the questions that's actually coming from our gallery, and this skips back a little bit to when we were talking about the Dummies book. From the publication of that book, did you hear anything from anybody about any increase in membership? Did you notice the book actually bring people to the fold? Or
I will tell you this. I get on air, and this will explain why when people send me emails, I don't always get back to them. I get between 200 and 300 emails every day. And I will say that possibly, you know, as many as 10 times a week, I'll get an email from somebody who said, because of your book, that made me go and find out and join a Masonic lodge. Or my father had talked to me about the fraternity, and I just blew it off, and somebody gave me your book, and that was the thing that motivated me to go join a Masonic lodge. That's the most gratifying thing about this entire experience. And now whether that has whether that translates into, you know, because of this book, numbers have increased around the country, I don't have any way of knowing that. I'm just saying anecdotally, the reaction has been really gratifying. And I have to say, the other thing that I find interesting is that there are Grand Lodges that are taking the book, and there are lodges and Grand Lodges that are taking the book and giving them to new candidates. What's interesting is that if you took the exact same book and put gray covers on it and called it Official Candidate Instruction Manual for the Grand Lodge of fill-in-the-blank, guys wouldn't read it, secretaries wouldn't order it, there would be warehouses filled with it, and it just wouldn't have the kind of impact. the beauty of the Dummies book is that guys will read the Dummies book or the Complete Idiots books because they're used to it. The entree of having already read Windows for Dummies and Golf for Dummies and Scuba Diving for Dummies, you know, they understand the series, they know what to expect with it, and so it breaks down a barrier that some official Grand Lodge publication just wouldn't necessarily do.
A tool to break the ice. It's surprising that they'd find it that way rather than something official. I can see the outside public, but the inside, that's interesting. One of the questions that's coming from our gallery is actually asking if you still have copies of the journal available at the Society.
If you join the Society now through certainly through the end of the year, when you join, you'll get a copy of the first issue.
There you go. So that's your answer out there. Greg,
I just want to mention as a sideline item is that if people are looking for the Dummies for Masonry book, we link in all our books we talk about in the show on the MasonicCentral.com website.
Yeah, we actually have it up. I've been hawking it for years for them, just out of my own liking of it. And you're a busy guy.
I will say there are people who absolutely object to the very name of it, that just think that it's an anathema. That you know, how dare you associate Dummies or Brent's book Idiots with the fraternity? That's insulting. And you know, I don't know how to answer that other than to say, you know, again, there are 1,000 Dummies titles out there, and to be honest with you, there is yet a third competing group of books there was a book on Freemasonry that was written by two non-Masons, and I would far rather that, whether it was me or Brad or anybody else, I would far rather that a Mason wrote the books than somebody that was doing a bunch of Wikipedia research and that was the extent of what they did. You know, it's funny. I saw somebody typed here on the questions, you know, which is better, the Idiot's book or the Dummy's book? It was interesting. I had a conversation with Brent Morris shortly after the book came out, and it was really interesting. He said, you know, I was working on my book at the same time that yours came out, and he said, I didn't want to read your book before I was finished with mine because I didn't want to intentionally copy anything that you'd done, and I didn't want to intentionally not copy anything that you'd done. I just didn't want your book to influence it, you know, so I just felt like I didn't want to read it. But he said, having said that, after it was done, he said, obviously, I think my book is better than yours in terms of the information. And he says, the difference between the books is, he said, Chris, yours is the more personal of the two books. And maybe that's probably the best way to describe the difference between the two of them. His has got more artwork. His has got more detailed information. But I tried to include personal reasons that, you know, why I joined and why others have joined, and try and put personal stories in it. And so if there's any difference, it's really that.
To make it more approachable.
So just two different ways of coming at the same information.
Very cool. Very cool. So now, and I know just in talking to you and trying to get the logistics for the show set up, you've been on the road quite a bit. Anything you want to tell us about on your recent tour of Washington, D.C.?
Yeah, I was, I was there working on a documentary for the History Channel that'll come out in the spring. And so that was interesting, having spent 20 some odd years as a filmmaker working the backside of the camera, I've suddenly become that thing I hated most, on camera talent. And having those discussions I despised about wardrobe and where we're having lunch. So yeah, it was sort of funny. But no, the and I don't want to to talk too much about the show, you know, in case titles change and all that stuff. But I will say it's principally not just about Freemasonry, but it's about the secrets of the founding fathers in Washington D.C. So it talks about the supposed Masonic symbolism in Washington. It talks about other symbolism, not Masonic, in the city and in the buildings. And there's a really broad spectrum of people that are being interviewed on it. So I think it'll be a very good show, in spite of the fact that I'm in it, and you know, I have a face made for radio. So
and you said that's coming out in spring, right, on Discover?
Yeah, it'll be on the History Channel.
History Channel. So we'll have to make a note of that and maybe book you back on for then. And you were on that trip on your birthday, no less.
I was. I celebrated my 50th birthday at Gadsby's Tavern, where George Washington used to eat and hang out. So you could be in worse places to celebrate your 50th birthday. So
I have no doubt. And anything else in 09 to keep an eye out for? Are you
any
other books or?
No, nothing that I can really talk about right now. But I'm going to be in San Antonio in January. I'm going to be in New York in April, and so yeah, just traveling around. It's again, the book has been a tremendous opportunity to travel the country and really travel the world, and really get a broad spectrum of the fraternity. It's truly been an amazing experience. If somebody told me 5 years ago any of this would have happened, I would have said they were out of their mind.
Roller coaster. It progressively builds one on top of the other. Justin, one question is just coming in from the gallery. It sounds like you're looking at it, but the question's really coming through as a simple one, just of any other recommendations on books, websites, anything else that
It really depends on what it is that you're concentrating on. I make a joke. The Library Museum for the Grand Lodge of Indiana is down in Franklin and kind of hard to get access to. I say, you know, if that had been in Indianapolis, you guys could have saved me about $4,000 in book purchases over the last 5 years. You know, I encourage everybody to get a hold of Coyle's Masonic Encyclopedia, just as the ultimate desk reference. And I absolutely encourage people to belong to the Scottish Rite Research Society for the annual copies of Heredum, and you know, and again, I mean, again, it just it depends on what it is that you're interested in. If you're interested in the history of the fraternity, you know, I don't know how that there's any real good concise history that's well written. Although Jasper Ridley did a book called The Freemasons a couple of years ago. He was a non-Mason, and it was interesting in that it was done as by an English non-Mason, and so it became sort of this massive who's who of the fraternity. And he really delved into it tremendously to give a broad overview of the whole fraternity. From a perspective that the Masons don't necessarily see. A lot of times we don't see the forest for the trees.
I know the Ridley book's one that I recommend quite often to anybody who's just looking for something to read on the fraternity. I mean, it's great history, and it just covers the whole thing that's legit.
Yeah, Stephen Bullock's Revolutionary Brotherhood is a tremendous book as well to talk about the development of Freemasonry in the United States.
The American aspect.
Mark Tabert's book, American Freemasons, is a wonderful book as well. It's very, very well researched, very well written, beautiful photography. Mark was the curator at the Scottish Rite Northern Jurisdictions Museum and Library at the time that he wrote it, and had access to tremendous artwork. So that's very, very good as well. But There's just what's been fascinating to me is that there has been an explosion, primarily driven by the Da Vinci Code and the rumor of the sequel, is that in the last, really in the last 4 years, there have been close to 70 books published by mainstream publishers about Freemasons. Now, that's unheard of in Masonic history. I mean, that has never happened before. And I got to tell you, Freemasons for Dummies has sold close to 70,000 copies, and so if somebody tells you that there isn't anybody interested in this fraternity, I got news for you. There's an awful lot of somebody's interested in Freemasonry. You know, I mean, ten years ago, my wife was researching the Freemasons for a character in a novel, and you know, you go down to the borders of the Barnes and Noble, and there was nothing but a thumbed through copy of Duncan's Ritual and nothing else. So it's very, very different today. And the good news is that with all of these mainstream publishers that are publishing all these books about the fraternity, the overwhelming majority of them are pretty factual. They absolutely outnumber the kookball books, so
bogus ones. Well, Chris, I hate to say it, we've actually hit our hour and we're running over. So I think we need to wrap it up. I hate to even cut you off. I think we could chat all night. Any chance you'd be willing to stick around afterward for anybody who
sure.
wanted to shoot the breeze in the parking lot like we normally do?
Sure, absolutely.
Cool. And all right. And for anybody out there who wants to maybe talk to Chris a little bit more, check out his blog. It's Freemasons with an S for Dummies. So freemasonsfordummies.blogspot.com. Or if you just throw Freemasons for Dummies, it's actually the first thing that comes up in Google is the blog,
yeah.
Believe it or not. And and you are not master this year of Lodge Vitruvian, are you?
No, I served for 2 years as Master of Vitruvian. I served Master as 1 year at Broad Ripple. No, the biggest thing I'm doing right now is I'm Sovereign Master of my AMD Council. So
there you go. So if
hey,
you're
Chris,
anywhere in...
there's a good deal on an apartment down the street from you. Do you want to buy it?
I'm no, I don't want to buy anything. God, I have turned in my plunger.
Oh no!
Just had
one,
to throw
two,
that
one.
In.
Thanks, Chris. Thanks for being here, and thanks for everybody who's been a part of our studio audience. And for those that listen for the future, check us out next week. We have I don't have my calendar up. Next week we have Pip Fox coming on. She's one of the co-authors of the book The Masonic Magician with Bob Cooper out of Scotland, which should be interesting. We're going to get a little bit back into Hermetica and the like. And then the week following, we in the 7th, we have something coming up that we need to confirm. We've been a little bit lax on it, and so we need to step up to that. Michael Anderson, if I'm not mistaken, out of Prince Hall of Texas. And then the 14th, we're off. I have an installation that Sunday evening, and nothing that I'm going into, but my lodge is
on
the Sunday.
There are no holidays in show business. You know that.
Yeah, you know, we can do it early, as Dean knows. Next week, actually, for anybody listening this week, next week for the 30th, our show is going to be at 2 o'clock in the afternoon on Pacific time.
That's California time.
California
you always
time,
do this
so
to me.
That's where I live. 2, 3, 4. So it's going to be 6 o'clock in Atlantic time, 5 o'clock on Eastern. So if you're listening to the show this week, next week it's going to be early, everybody, because our guest's in England, early. And then at the end of December on the 21st, we still have our table lodge scheduled, which I have no clue how we're going to do yet. But Chris, I invite you to come on to our table lodge, which will probably be just a lot of people laughing, talking, and carrying on. We'll kind of do it as a end of year party for Masonic Central.
I'm sorry if there's drinking involved. I can't.
All over the phone. No one's going to know what you're doing. So that's coming up on the show. Again, anybody out there, check out Freemasons for Dummies at Chris's day-to-day stuff is. Pick up Freemasons for Dummies, the book, or the Solomon's Builders, the book. And then you can read some more of his work or check out the Masonic Society, where you can pick up the first issue of the journal and look for the exciting second issue of the journal coming out, too. Thanks, Dean. You got anything you want to throw in there?
Greg, man, you don't leave me with much material to work with here. I just want to remind all the guests that we do have a post show program that you're welcome to come in and participate with. I'll liven up everyone's mic at that time, and they're welcome to you know, ask questions and discuss. We usually go on for quite a while, and at that, Greg, I think we can close up this show today. And
right on.
Are you ready?
I am ready. Thanks, Chris, for being here. This is Greg Stewart and
Dean Kennedy saying.
Saying travel.
Travel? What light?
Light. We're getting too good at it. We're getting close.
I know. Hold on. Let me stop this.